such a rare thing that love of humanity should find this particular form of expression in the rescue of souls? And however the bishop may have satisfied himself that there ought to be nothing so remarkable about it at all, the public continued to talk, and the churches to record their astonishment that two such men, so prominent in the ministry, should leave their comfortable homes, voluntarily resign their pleasant social positions, and enter upon a life of hardship, of self-denial, and actual suffering. Christian America. Is it a reproach on the form of our discipleship that the exhibition of actual suffering for Jesus on the part of those who walk in his steps always provokes astonishment as at the sight of something very unusual? Nazareth Avenue Church parted from its pastor with regret for the most part, although the regret was modified with a feeling of relief on the part of those who had refused to take the pledge. Dr. Bruce carried with him the respect of men who, entangled in business in such a way that obedience to the pledge would have ruined them, still held in their deeper, better natures a genuine admiration for courage and consistency. They had known Dr. Bruce many years as a kindly, conservative, safe man, but the thought of him in the light of sacrifice of this sort was not familiar to them. As fast as they understood it, they gave their pastor the credit of being absolutely true to his recent convictions as to what following Jesus meant. Nazareth Avenue Church never lost the impulse of that movement started by Dr. Bruce. Those who went with him in making the promise breathed into the church the very breath of divine life and are continuing that life-giving work at this present time. It was fall again, and the city faced another hard winter. The bishop one afternoon came out of the settlement and walked around the block, intending to go on a visit to one of his new friends in the district. He had walked about four blocks when he was attracted by a shop that looked different from the others. The neighborhood was still quite new to him, and every day he discovered some strange spot or stumbled upon some unexpected humanity. The place that attracted his notice was a small house close by a Chinese laundry. There were two windows in the front, very clean, and that was remarkable to begin with. Then, inside the window, was a tempting display of cookery, with prices attached to the various articles that made him wonder somewhat, for he was familiar by this time with many facts in the life of the people once unknown to him. As he stood looking at the windows, the door between them opened, and Felicia Sterling came out. "Felicia," exclaimed the bishop, "when did you move into my parish without my knowledge?" "How did you find me so soon?" inquired Felicia. "Why, don't you know? These are the only clean windows in the block." "I believe they are," replied Felicia with a laugh that did the bishop good to hear. "But why have you dared to come to Chicago without telling me? And how have you entered my diocese without my knowledge?" asked the bishop. And Felicia looked so like that beautiful, clean, educated, refined world he once knew that he might be pardoned for seeing in her something of the old paradise, although, to speak truth for him, he had no desire to go back to it. "Well, dear bishop," said Felicia, who had always called him so, "I knew how overwhelmed you were with your work. I did not want to burden you with my plans, and besides, I am going to offer you my services. Indeed, I was just on my way to see you and ask your advice. I am settled here for the present with Mrs. Bascom, a saleswoman who rents our three rooms, and with one of Rachel's music pupils who is being helped to a course in violin by Virginia Page. She is from the people," continued Felicia, using the words "from the people" so gravely and unconsciously that her hearer smiled, "and I am keeping house for her, and at the same time beginning an experiment in pure food for the masses. I am an expert, and I have a plan I want you to admire and develop. Will you, dear bishop?" "Indeed I will," he replied. The sight of Felicia and her remarkable vitality, enthusiasm, and evident purpose almost bewildered him. "Martha can help at the settlement with her violin, and I will help with my messes. You see, I thought I would get settled first and work out something, and then come with some real thing to offer. I'm able to earn my own living now."
"You are?" the bishop said a little incredulously.
"How? Making those things?"
"Those things," said Felicia with a show of indignation. "I would have you know, sir, that those things are the best cooked, purest food products in this whole city. I don't doubt it, he replied hastily while his eyes twinkled. Still, the proof of the pudding, and you know the rest. Come in and try some, she exclaimed. You poor bishop, you look as if you hadn't had a good meal for a month. She insisted on his entering the little front room where Martha, a wide-awake girl with short, curly hair and an unmistakable air of music about her, was busy with practice. Go right on, Martha. This is the bishop. You have heard me speak of him so often. Sit down there and let me give you a taste of the flesh pots of Egypt, for I believe you have been actually fasting. So they had an improvised lunch, and the bishop, who, to tell the truth, had not taken time for weeks to enjoy his meals, feasted on the delight of his unexpected discovery, and was able to express his astonishment and gratification at the quality of the cookery. I thought you would at least say it is as good as the meals you used to get at the auditorium at the big banquet, said Felicia slyly. As good as? The auditorium banquets were simply husks compared with this one, Felicia. But you must come to the settlement. I want you to see what we are doing, and I am simply astonished to find you here earning your living this way. I begin to see what your plan is. You can be of infinite help to us. You don't really mean that you will live here and help these people to know the value of good food. Indeed I do, she answered gravely. That is my gospel. Shall I not follow it? Aye, you're right. Bless God for sense like yours. When I left the world, the bishop smiled at the phrase, they were talking a good deal about the new woman. If you are one of them, I am a convert, right now and here. Flattery. Still, there is no escape from it, even in the slums of Chicago. Felicia laughed again. In the man's heart, heavy though it had grown during several months of vast sin-bearing, rejoiced to hear it. It sounded good. It was good. It belonged to God. Felicia wanted to visit the settlement and went back with him. She was amazed at the results of what considerable money and a good deal of concentrated brains had done. As they walked through the building, they talked incessantly. She was the incarnation of vital enthusiasm, and he wondered at this exhibition of it as it bubbled up and sparkled over. They went down into the basement, and the bishop pushed open a door from behind, which came the sound of a carpenter's plane. It was a small but well-equipped carpenter's shop. A young man with a paper cap on his head and clad in blouse and overalls was whistling and driving the plane as he whistled. He looked up as the two entered and took off his cap. As he did so, his little finger carried a small curling shaving up to his hair, and it caught there. Miss Sterling, Mr. Stephen Clyde, said the bishop. Clyde is one of our helpers here 2 afternoons in the week. Just then the bishop was called upstairs, and he excused himself a moment, leaving Felicia and the young carpenter together. We have met before, said Felicia, looking at Clyde frankly. Yes, back in the world, as the bishop says, replied the young man. His fingers trembled a little as they lay on the board he had been planing. Yes, Felicia hesitated. I am very glad to see you. Are you? The flush of pleasure mounted on the young carpenter's forehead. You have had a great deal of trouble since then, he said, and then he was afraid he had wounded her or called up painful memories. But she had lived over all that. Yes, and you also. How is it that you're working here? It is a long story, Miss Sterling. My father lost his money and I was obliged to go to work, a very good thing for me. The bishop says I ought to be very grateful. I am. I am very happy now. I learned the trade, hoping sometime to be of use. I am night clerk at one of the hotels. That Sunday morning when you took the pledge at Nazareth Avenue Church, I took it with the others. Did you? Said Felicia slowly. I am glad. Just then the bishop came back, and very soon he and Felicia went away, leaving the young carpenter at his work. Someone noticed that he whistled louder than ever as he planed. Felicia, said the bishop, did you know Stephen Clyde before? Yes, back in the world, dear bishop. He was one of my acquaintances in Nazareth Avenue Church. Ah, said the bishop. We were very good friends, added Felicia. But nothing more? The bishop ventured to ask. Felicia's face glowed for an instant. Then she looked her companion in the eyes frankly and answered, truly and truly, nothing more. It would be just the way of the world for these two people to come to like each other, though, thought the man to himself, and somehow the thought made him grave. It was almost like the old pang over Camilla, but it passed, leaving him afterwards, when Felicia had gone back, with tears in his eyes and a feeling that was almost hope that Felicia and Stephen would like each other. After all, he said, like the sensible good man that he was, is not romance a part of humanity? Love is older than I am, and wiser. The week following, the bishop had an experience that belongs to this part of the settlement history. He was coming back to the settlement very late from some gathering of the striking tailors, and was walking along with his hands behind him, when two men jumped out from behind an old fence that shut off an abandoned factory from the street, and faced him. One of the men thrust a pistol in his face, and the other threatened him with a ragged stake that had evidently been torn from the fence. "Hold up your hands and be quick about it," said the man with the pistol. Chapter 27. Righteousness shall go before him, and shall set us in the way of his steps. The bishop was not in the habit of carrying much money with him, and the man with the stake who was searching him uttered an oath at the small amount of change he found. As he uttered it, the man with the pistol savagely said, "Jerk out his watch. We might as well get all we can out of the job." The man with the stake was on the point of laying hold of the chain where there was a sound of footsteps coming towards him. "Get behind the fence. We haven't half searched him yet. Mind you keep shut now if you don't want." The man with the pistol made a significant gesture with it and, with his companion, pulled and pushed the bishop down the alley and through a ragged, broken opening in the fence. The three stood there in the shadow until the footsteps passed. "Now, then, have you got the watch?" asked the man with the pistol. "No, the chain is caught somewhere," said the other man, swore again. "Break it, then." "No, don't break it," the bishop said, and it was the first time he had spoken. "The chain is a gift of a very dear friend. I should be sorry to have it broken." At the sound of the bishop's voice, the man with the pistol started as if he had been suddenly shot by his own weapon. With a quick movement of his other hand, he turned the bishop's head toward what little light was shining from the alleyway, at the same time taking a step nearer. Then, to the amazement of his companion, he said roughly, "Leave the watch alone. We've got the money. That's enough." "Enough? 50 cents? You don't reckon..." Before the man with the stake could say another word, he was confronted with the muzzle of the pistol, turned from the bishop's head toward his own. "Leave that watch be, and put back the money, too. This is the bishop we've held up. The bishop, do you hear?" "And what of it? The President of the United States wouldn't be too good to hold up if..." "I say you put the money back, or in 5 seconds I'll blow a hole through your head. That'll let in more sense than you have to spare now," said the other. For a second, the man with the stake seemed to hesitate at this strange turn in events, as if measuring his companion's intention. Then he hastily dropped the money back into the rifle pocket. "You can take your hands down, sir." The man lowered his weapon slowly, still keeping the eye on the other man, and speaking with rough respect. The bishop slowly brought his arms to his side and looked earnestly at the two men. In the dim light, it was difficult to distinguish features. He was evidently free to go his way now, but he stood there making no movement. "You can go on. You needn't stay any longer on our account." The man who had acted as spokesman turned and sat down on a stone. The other man stood viciously digging his stake into the ground. "That's just what I am staying for," replied the bishop. He sat down on a board that projected from the broken fence. "You must like our company. It is hard sometimes for people to tear themselves away from us." The man standing up laughed coarsely. "Shut up," exclaimed the other. "We're on the road to hell, though, that's sure enough. We need better company than ourselves and the devil." "If you would only allow me to be of any help," the bishop spoke gently, even lovingly. The man on the stone stared at the bishop through the darkness. After a moment of silence, he spoke slowly, like one who had finally decided upon a course he had at first rejected. "Do you remember ever seeing me before?" "No," said the bishop. "The light is not very good, and I have really not had a good look at you." "Do you know me now?" The man suddenly took off his hat, and getting up from the stone, walked over to the bishop until they were near enough to touch each other. The man's hair was coal black, except one spot on the top of his head, about as large as the palm of the hand, which was white. The minute the bishop saw that, he started. The memory of 15 years ago began to stir in him. The man helped him. "Don't you remember one day back in 81 or 82, a man came to your house and told a story about his wife and child having been burned to death in a tenement fire in New York?" "Yes, I begin to remember now." The other man seemed to be interested. He ceased digging his stake in the ground and stood still listening. "Do you remember how you took me into your house that night and spent all next day trying to find me a job? And how when you succeeded in getting me a place in a warehouse as foreman, I promised to quit drinking because you asked me to? I remember it now. I hope you have kept your promise." The man laughed savagely. Then he struck his hand against the fence with such sudden passion that it drew blood. "Kept it? I was drunk inside of a week. I've been drinking ever since. But I've never forgotten you, nor your prayer. Do you remember the morning after I came to your house? After breakfast, you had prayers and asked me to come in and sit with the rest. That got me. But my mother used to pray. I can see her now kneeling down by my bed when I was a lad. Father came in one night and kicked her while she was kneeling there by me. But I never forgot that prayer of yours that morning. You prayed for me just as mother used to, and you didn't seem to take account of the fact that I was ragged and tough-looking and more than half-drunk when I rang your doorbell. Oh, what a life I've lived. The saloon has housed me and homed me and made hell on earth for me. But that prayer stuck to me all the time. My promise not to drink was broken into 1,000 pieces inside of 2 Sundays, and I lost the job you found for me and landed in a police station 2 days later. But I never forgot you nor your prayer. I don't know what good it has done me, but I never forgot it, and I won't do any harm to you nor let anyone else, so you're free to go. That's why." The bishop did not stir. Somewhere a church clock struck one. The man had put on his hat and gone back to his seat on the stone. The bishop was thinking hard. "How long is it since you had work?" he asked, and the man standing up answered for the other. "More than 6 months since either of us did anything to tell of, unless you count holding up work. I call it pretty wearing kind of job myself, especially when we put in a night like this and don't make nothing." "Suppose I found good jobs for both of you. Would you quit this and begin all over?" "What's the use?" the man on the stone spoke sullenly. "I've reformed 100 times. Every time I go down deeper. The devil's begun to foreclose on me already. It's too late." "No," said the bishop. And never before the most entranced audience had he felt the desire for souls burn up in him so strongly. All the time he sat there during the remarkable scene, he prayed, "O Lord Jesus, give me the souls of these two for thee. I am hungry for them. Give them to me." "No," the bishop repeated. "What does God want of you two men? It doesn't so much matter what I want, but He wants just what I do in this case. You two men are of infinite value to Him." And then His wonderful memory came to His aid in an appeal such as no one on earth among men could make under such circumstances. He had remembered the man's name in spite of the wonderfully busy years that lay between his coming to the house and the present moment. "Burns," he said, and he yearned over the men with an unspeakable longing for them both. "If you and your friend here will go home with me tonight, I will find you both places of honorable employment. I will believe in you and trust you. You are both comparatively young men. Why should God lose you? It is a great thing to win the love of the great Father. It is a small thing that I should love you. But if you need to feel again that there is love in the world, you will believe me when I say, my brothers, that I love you. And in the name of Him who was crucified for our sins, I cannot bear to see you miss the glory of the human life. Come, be men. Make another try for it, God helping you. No one but God and you and myself need ever know anything of this tonight.